From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, in his new cover article for National Geographic magazine, science writer Carl Zimmer explores the inner workings of the human mind and delves into the latest technologies on mapping the brain and finding out what specific neurons do, including one neuron that's only triggered by pictures of Jennifer Aniston. We'll talk with Zimmer about how far science of the mind has come and how far it still needs to go before we can answer questions about consciousness and free will, and we'll look at new and exciting inroads to neuroscience. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. New technologies are shedding new light on how the brain works, and scientists who in a number of instances are working toward what is being called a theory of the brain are now able to look deep into the brain's hidden structures. As famed science writer Carl Zimmer writes in the February issue of National Geographic, quote, thought, feeling, sense, action all derive from unimaginably complex interactions among billions of nerve cells. In this Forum Hour, we explore the brain and new methods and new research, which are bringing more understanding to us about how the brain works. And Carl Zimmer joins us from his home in Connecticut. He writes frequently for National Geographic and the New York Times and is a three-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award, certainly one of our leading science journalists. And his article, A Voyage into the Brain, is on the cover of the latest National Geographic magazine. Carl Zimmer, so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, delighted. And let me just begin by telling listeners that you highlight for us how the brain is connected by 100,000 miles of fibers called white matter, enough to circle the Earth four times and looking like the latitude and longitude of a map. This can all be highlighted, and we see this in the National Geographic article, by different colors now, and is highlighted by different colors. What is this coloring, and they're fantastic pictures, by the way, but what does this coloring do for us?
Well, it's one way to be able to kind of navigate your way through the brain. We have all of these fibers connecting our billions of neurons, and it's so complicated that, you know, scientists are really only just starting to figure out a lot of the structure of it. And so it helps sometimes to actually color a single fiber different colors along its length so that you can kind of get a sense of the overall shape of these things, because these fibers have this marvelous geometry. They swirl and they curve and they intersect with each other in very strange patterns. If you zoom down to the sort of the finest structure, some scientists have argued that actually they form a grid, almost like a set of city streets. So it's really fascinating, and it's a real challenge just to visualize what scientists are seeing in there.
Well, you certainly help us in this article that's, as I say, a cover story in National Geographic in the February issue. You see pink and orange lines transmitting signals that are essentially used for language and all of that. And I think Van Weeden, one of those that you interviewed over in Boston Harbor, who has this Center for Biomedical Imagery, says it looks like a psychedelic Persian cat because it's all grids.
Yeah. So for this story, I paid a visit to Van Weeden, who is a neuroscientist at the Martinos Center for Biomedical Imaging, which is run by Harvard and MIT and Massachusetts General Hospital. And they're doing amazing work there, basically pushing technology as hard as it can go to take more and more detailed pictures of the brain. And I actually, you know, volunteered to be a guinea pig and let him scan my brain. And so you just have to try to hold really still for what ended up being about an hour in a very tight cylinder. Not a lot of fun, but it was pretty amazing to see the images that came out, because he was actually able to then show me my own brain and zoom in, spin it around, and show different areas. So he could show me the fibers that would link language centers of the brain with other areas of the brain. And you can start to get a feel for that circuitry in your head, which is actually making your existence as a thinking person possible.
Well, as listeners may remember, last spring, President Obama announced a large-scale government project to essentially speed up the mapping of the Well, the neural circuitry of the brain, and we spoke about that and covered that on forum, but I think it's important to realize different brain structures are the order of the day when we're talking about things like autism, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia. So this kind of research can lead to really pioneering and groundbreaking territory.
I agree. And it's, you know, there really won't be a way to grapple with a lot of disorders of the brain without first really understanding how the brain is organized and how it works. So, you know, we cannot just, you know, look at one person's brain on its own and say, aha, this person has autism or this person has schizophrenia. You can start to see some patterns if you look at hundreds of brains of people with one disorder versus another, but we're nowhere near, you know, getting to down to like diagnostic precision. And so we just need to be able to get better detail. When you see a picture of a brain, a pretty MRI picture in a magazine, say, I mean, with all gorgeous colors where the brain seems to be lighting up in different regions, you know, you have to remember that that's just showing you where blood is flowing in the brain. And the resolution of that picture only gets down to about a size of a peppercorn. And inside of each of those peppercorns, there are hundreds of thousands of neurons that are doing all sorts of complex things. So we still only have this very rough picture of the brain. We have a very rough idea of the different types of cells in the brain. One scientist has described the way we deal with disorders of the brain, you know, with medication, is kind of like, let's say you've got a car that's you're having trouble with it, you know, and it needs an oil change, and so you pull open the hood and you just sort of pour oil all over the engine. Well, you know, maybe some of it gets where it's supposed to go, but a lot of it doesn't, and it's a very, primitive way of dealing with it. And that's kind of where we're at, unfortunately, right now with a lot of aspects of dealing with the brain.
We're talking with Carl Zimmer, who is a leading science writer, and his article, A Voyage into the Brain, is cover story for the latest National Geographic magazine. And we certainly don't know a lot, but we're learning so much more than we knew before. I mean, we were long historically ignorant, and you know, when I read some of this stuff about axons and dendrites and neurotransmitters and all that connectedness that you write about, and a lot of it is certainly formidable in terms of getting the mind and the brain around, it seems to kind of almost boil down to a lot of electricity and chemistry.
Well, there certainly is a lot of electricity and chemistry involved, no doubt about that. And just understanding that the brain depends on chemistry and depends on electricity, these were some of the most important insights in the history of science. I mean, people have been struggling to figure out what the brain is and how it works for many centuries. It's maybe hard to believe, but in ancient Greece, many people thought that either the brain was just phlegm. Aristotle thought that it was just there to keep the brain, keep the heart cool. And then, you know, other people thought that there are great big chambers inside of our heads that the brain surrounded. And it was these chambers where what we call animal spirits would whoosh around, and that would create memory and emotions and so on. So, you know, what's happening right now in neuroscience is just part of a 2,000-year-long struggle to understand what the brain is. And in some ways, we're just starting to figure it out.
No, it's just 3 pounds of flesh, right? I mean, a little bigger in men than women for some strange reason that can't be determined, particularly since women often seem so much more intuitive. But let's talk about, you profile so many of the leading researchers here. I want to talk with you about Jeff Lichtman, who's working with neurons up in Harvard and actually finding rules behind a lot of this chaos that we don't understand.
Yeah, so Jeff Lichtman is part of a project at Harvard that, and other researchers are doing similar things elsewhere, but he's really a pioneer. And what they're doing is they're trying to draw out the brain in full detail. So each neuron has a little input. It looks kind of like a root, and signals come into the neuron that way, and then it has an output kind of root, and these are the axons and dendrites you mentioned, and they make contact with lots of other neurons, a huge amount of neurons, actually. And so what he wanted to do was to map that out in full detail. And so what he does is he and his colleagues, they freeze a tiny portion of a mouse's brain, you know, the size of a salt crystal, and then take incredibly thin slices of that piece and photograph each one. And then they basically take those photographs like a stack and create a three-dimensional image of all those neurons. And, you know, it's actually kind of crazy that, you know, there is the same amount of data for a picture, a 3D picture of a grain of salt's worth of brain as there are in hundreds of high-definition movies. It's incredibly complicated. And just in a tiny little portion of that, you can find these neurons just all packed in and making all sorts of crazy contacts with each other. And it looks at first like just chaos. I mean, it just it just looks like too much for you to make sense of. But Dr. Lichtman and his colleagues are actually finding that there are certain rules about how neurons connect with other neurons. One neuron will tend to form most of its connections with one other neuron, and you know it will actually sort of kind of jostle its way past other neurons in order to do that. So scientists like Dr. Lichtman are just starting to find these rules underneath this apparent chaos.
And maybe people thought I was joking, but you have nerve cells even responding to specific faces we know now. So there is a Jennifer Aniston nerve cell that they've discovered at UCLA, or a Halle Berry nerve cell.
Well, basically, if you become familiar with anybody's face, there will be a few neurons, perhaps a few hundred neurons, and scientists aren't exactly sure how many, that will respond most strongly to that one person, which is pretty amazing. And those same neurons will actually respond most strongly even to the name of that person. So our brains have this incredible capacity to store vast amounts of information, and it turns out that you don't need a whole lot of neurons to do that, to store each chunk of that information. And so the brain uses a way of storing information, sometimes called sparse coding, which allows it to dedicate just a few neurons to each little piece of information. And then when you have billions of neurons, there's a lot of information you can store in there.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I think, let me quote you from the article, each type of neuron uses a distinct set of genes to build the molecular machinery it needs to do its own job.
That's right. That's right. So the human genome contains about 20,000 genes. So those are, each one of those is a stretch of DNA that encodes a protein. And scientists at the Allen Brain Institute have actually done a survey of the whole brain, and they've been able to show that 84% of all those genes are active somewhere in the brain. So our brains are tapping into pretty much most of the versatility of the human genome in order to work. And you'll find different combinations of those genes active in different areas of the brain, different kinds of neurons. And so there might be hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of different types of neurons in our brain, each with a special combination of genes that it's using to do its own special kind of task.
Talking with Carl Zimmer, who is with us from his home in Connecticut, one of our leading science journalists and three-time winner, in fact, of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award. He has a cover story in the latest National Geographic magazine called A Voyage into the Brain about the brain. And getting closer to home here for a minute, Carl Zimmer, you, among the many you profile in the article, you talk about Stanford neuroscientist Carol Dieseroth, who has this method called Clarity to actually see more of the brain. But, you know, it strikes me, and we're going to talk in a moment with neuroscientist Christoph Koch about, well, the work that they're doing up in Seattle at the Allen Institute for the Brain. But we're talking about the human brain being three times as large as a mouse brain. So to some degree, how much can we really learn from all this? And we'll find out more, as I say, when we talk to Christoph Koch. But all this emphasis, like Carl Diesenroth and others, Christoph Koch, on the mouse brain.
Yeah, actually, so the human brain is actually hundreds of times bigger than the mouse brain, which makes the problem you address even more important. Like, what are we supposed to learn from a mouse brain that can apply to a human brain? Because we and mice evolved from a common ancestor, our brains are surprisingly similar. You have same kinds of neurons. You have a lot of the same regions of the brain in mice and humans. And they function in many of the same ways. And so this is why scientists are able to do all sorts of experiments on brains in mice. I mean, mice get addicted to drugs the way that humans do. Mice get depressed the way that humans do. And so the parallels can be really surprising once you delve into it. And so if you can understand the mouse brain, if you can see into the mouse brain the way that Carl Diesenroth can do now by turning it transparent, there's a lot that you can understand about the structure of our own brain. And you can get clues, which you could then use to sort of guide your study of the human brain. You can't just jump into the human brain without any sort of guiding ideas. You need a little help, and the mouse can provide you with that help. And now Carl Diesenroth, now that he actually has figured out how to turn the mouse brain transparent and then add in colors for different types of neurons, he and his colleagues actually are now starting to work on a human brain and trying to turn an entire brain, human brain, transparent and look inside of it. And that will be truly amazing.
Let me bring Christoph Koch, whom I mentioned a moment ago, into this conversation. He's a neuroscientist and chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, and doing a lot of original work, particularly with mice and the brains of mice. Christoph Koch, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Michael, and hi, Carl.
We should mention, by the way, Seattle is not necessarily a favorite word here in San Francisco now, but we're glad to have you with us nonetheless. There are, as Carl Zimmer points out in his article, there are about 10,000 labs pursuing questions about the brain, but yours has a lot of money thanks to Microsoft and Paul Allen. What are you doing up there? You got brain observatories for mice cerebral cortexes? Is that what I'm reading?
Yeah, we're building brain observatories for mice and also for the human brain. The idea is, you know, we spend untold hundreds of millions of dollars to build telescopes to peer out at galaxies and the origin of space-time. And so with related technologies, we're building observatories to peer at the brain that give rise to our mind.
So you're seeing how a mouse sees, really, aren't you?
That's what we're trying to do, yeah. And as Carl already pointed out, if you look at a little bit of human brain, you look at a little bit of a monkey brain or mouse brain, it's very difficult to tell the difference. It takes an expert arm with a microscope to tell a little grain, you know, if I give you a grain of rice of brain matter to be certain whether it's a mouse brain or human brain. The basic material is all the same. It's just the human brain is roughly 1,000 times bigger than the mouse brain. But the basic components, the synapses, the neurons, the genes, they're all very similar. They're not the same, but they're very similar.
And dendrites and synapses in the circuits, all those?
They have all of that stuff, yeah. I mean, as I said, if I show you a neuron, you can't tell me, oh, that's a human neuron or that's a mouse neuron, because the basic hardware is the same.
And you're using 3D electron microscopy, excuse me, as well as MRIs?
We're using a host of technologies. So it's we stick thousands of tiny wires inside the brain. We do brain imaging where we can convert the electrical activity. You know, neurons have all this electrical activity just like in a computer. We can convert that electrical activity into flashes of light. And so using optical techniques, we can track those flashes of light. We do electron microscopy where we cut it into tiny, tiny, tiny itsy-bitsy slices and reassemble it in a computer. We try to model it all. We try to build a computer model of the way the mouse sees.
Now, as I understand it from reading Carl Zimmer, this really could revolutionize our understanding of the mammalian brain. I mean, this is of mice and men, I realize, to quote Steinbeck, but 70 million neurons to compared to 86 billion for those of us in the human species, or vision, which you're looking at areas. You got 1 to 2 million in mice and, a couple of billion. Billions in humans. I mean, it just seems that we're so much more vastly complicated.
We are much bigger, roughly 1,000 times bigger. It's entirely true. But I mean, once again, a lot of the diseases that we fall prey to mice also have, a lot of the pathologies, and since the basic stuff is the same, scientists believe it. Now, of course, we can do experiments in animals much easier than we can do, ethically-wise, we can do many experiments in animals that we can't do in humans. So we first need to study the animal brain and understand it, and we have a better chance of doing that right now just because it's smaller and possibly less complex than a human brain. And then ultimately, we need to move from a mouse into the human brain.
Well, we mentioned Jeff Lichtman of Harvard before in a conversation with Carl Zimmer. And I know Clay Reed is in Seattle. He's a former colleague of Lichtman's. And
correct.
Some of these experiments, which he calls MindScope, are actually also concentrating on vision. We're talking about not only reconstructing what a mouse sees, but really kind of reading its mind, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. That's why we call it MindScope. The idea is to record from thousands of its cells while the animal's running. So what you can do now, you can get the animal to run on a little trackball, just like a hamster. And back home when you were a kid, they love to run. But now what you can do, what you couldn't do with your hamster when you were a kid, you can make a little window, a little glass window into the skull. You can operate that. And then you can actually see, using these optical tricks I mentioned, you can actually see the electrical activity of the nerve cells as the animal is running or deciding whether it should move to the left or to the right or stop or not stop. So you can literally peer at its brain, and then we have techniques where we can infer, mathematical algorithms where we can infer what the mouse saw based on these optical recordings. So in that sense, we're beginning to read the mind of the mouse in a very precise way. And I think you talked also about Jennifer Aniston in human, when you can record that during neurosurgery. So in a human, we can begin to do these experiments, but on a very rare condition, and we don't have the control, and we can only do it, haphazardly or in a very few patients. While in mice, we and our colleagues can do it routinely every day now.
This is all extraordinary stuff, and it's giving us more and more understanding of the brain as we move forward with new technologies and new research. And you may want to join this conversation. In fact, I'd like to take this opportunity to invite you to do that. In fact, we welcome your calls and emails. You can call us now at our toll-free number if you have questions or comments or would simply like to join the conversation. Toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website. And our website is kqed.org/forum and simply click on the segment. You, too, can become a part of the program. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And as I spoke of earlier, Carl Zimmer, we're talking about kind of a unified field theory here about the brain, which is the grail.
Yeah, scientists that I would speak to, including Christoph, would sometimes refer to a theory of the brain as being, what they would like to get to ultimately. We have theories of all sorts of things. We have theories of quantum physics, and we have theories about heredity, about DNA, for example. This is an explanation that is relatively short and sweet, but incredibly powerful in explaining something complicated. We don't have a theory of the brain yet, but the work of Calk and others might actually get us there.
Well, we're going to continue our discussion about the brain, and we welcome your involvement in the program. Feel free to join us, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. No, it's not Science Friday. We are talking about unlocking secrets of the human brain in this opening hour of Forum on this day to commemorate Martin Luther King Day. And we're talking with Carl Zimmer, who is a science writer. He writes frequently for National Geographic and the New York Times and is three-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award. His lead article in the cover issue of the February National Geographic is called A Voyage into the Brain. And Christoph Quach is also with us. He's a neuroscientist and is chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. And it's an opportunity for you to bring up any questions you might have about the brain and how it works or doesn't work. In fact, I was going to ask you, Carl Zimmer, with these cases in both here in the Bay Area in Oakland and in Texas getting a tremendous amount of attention in terms of, you know, how to determine whether someone is, quote, brain dead or not. All this research and all these new technologies, are we any more into the understanding of what we can term, you know, what is it, a live brain versus a dead brain?
Well, I think that we're being kind of thrust into a very confusing new world where technology can basically put us into kind of quandaries about what we do in these sort of situations. I mean, it used to be, you know, 100 years ago, people who would, in these sort of situations, would simply be dead. I mean, we would not have the technology to keep them, keep their bodies going. So now we have a couple cases just now where you have two people where, you know, much of their brain is gone. And, you know, they don't have the capacity in their brains to keep breathing. If you hook them up to machines and you put oxygen in their lungs, you know, their heart will still keep beating. And so, you know, people feel like, well, if their heart is beating, they must be alive. But really that it really pushes you to ask, well, what does it mean to be alive? And for, you know, for hospitals, for neurologists, really, I mean, the brain death is equivalent to death, you know, when there's no hope that the brain is going to be to recover. There are more ambiguous situations where people have suffered, you know, large amounts of brain damage, but not as much as these recent cases. You know, they're not brain dead. They're, you know, they go into a coma and then they go into a vegetative state.
I mean, and Clarence Seibel was a case like that.
Exactly, yeah. And these are, you know, then this gets to be very complicated because then the question becomes, you know, well, is there quote unquote someone in there? Can we communicate with them? And there are attempts to actually, you know, come up with ways to use, say, brain scanning to say, you know, to tell someone in a vegetative state, okay, picture yourself playing tennis and see if you can see those areas of the brain that would light up. So the kinds of technologies we've been talking about might help us to better understand people who are in that kind of that very hard to comprehend vegetative state.
Yeah, in fact, I want to get to our callers here, but you write about this young woman, Kathy Hutchinson, who was paralyzed, and you had this brain machine that interfaces and changes people's lives, like hers.
That's right. So I visited a woman named Kathy Hutchinson who had suffered from a stroke, and, you know, she had, you know, basically her doctors thought she was dying. She was lying in bed. She was totally uncommunicative. And eventually her sister started, you know, realized that she could ask her questions and Kathy could respond just by sort of fluttering her or moving her eyes a little bit. And that's basically all she could handle. And today, you know, she's in a wheelchair. All she can do is sort of move her head a little bit. And a computer can basically track the movement of her head and use that to control the keyboard. It's incredibly slow and cumbersome and difficult. She can communicate, but she's really trapped. And so she participated in a project at Brown University. There are other projects like this going on elsewhere where basically scientists will put electrodes into people's brains and then decode the information, the signals from those neurons, and use that to start to control things, control a keyboard, control, for example, a robot arm. And so Kathy Hutchinson was a real pioneer in this. She was one of the first people to really be able to control an arm. She actually was able to give herself to grab a cup of coffee and grab a cup of tea and drink it. And so, you know, that could be a really exciting near-term application of these advances in understanding the structure of the brain.
All right, let me bring our listeners in here, and we'll begin with Josh. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. So I just had two quick questions. One sort of the science, and one's the human level for Christoph Koch. Basically, a lot of people focus on the synaptics, or for lack of a better term, the mechanical connections of neurons. But I'm just curious if his work with Paul Allen up in Seattle might also, some of your own work, Professor, is also on like a faptic coupling, or both the chemical and the electromagnetic causal connections, if you will, between neurons. Number one, are you guys focusing on that a bit? And then number two, the human aspect. Sometimes I ask neuroscientists about local field potential and faptic coupling, and they sort of laugh it off like it doesn't matter.
No, so we are looking at faptic coupling. So faptic coupling is direct coupling via the electric field, as George mentioned, both in the mouse brain. In fact, we've just built a very sophisticated computer model of the brain that includes this faptic coupling. And people are, every time you stick a piece of wire to record, every time you stick a microelectrode into a brain, whether it's a human brain or a mouse brain, you pick up the electric field. As you mentioned, the local field potential, that's actually what you measure and then amplify. In fact, you can hear the distant echo of the local field potential on the outside of the skull. That's so-called brain waves. That's what you pick up by the EEG. The question is, which we don't know right now, to what extent the electrical field itself can cause or can influence other neurons to fire. That remains more open question. There's now a technique now called direct current stimulation, whereby people put electrodes on top of their head, on their skull, either AC or DC current, to try to influence their brain, and that has to a certain extent works, but how that works in detail we don't really know. So that's an open question. Most of the research, as you mentioned, Joss, is still focuses on the synaptic level, since that we know for certain that's where the vast majority of the traffic occurs.
I don't know, Christoph Koch, if this is in your bailiwick, so to speak, but there was an article that caught my attention in the Sunday New York Times magazine you might have seen. It was a cover story about mindfulness and the effect. I'm just wondering about the neuroscience behind this, because they're talking about the effect on white matter can be obviously creative, with the mind wandering as opposed to being cognitively focused on something. In fact, we had Dan Goleman on talking about that.
Yeah, but we don't know. So I spent a week with His Holiness the Dalai Lama talking about the neuroscience of mindfulness, specifically in the neuroscience. It's now called meditative neuroscience, where you can stick monks in magnets, or you stick people who are practitioners of certain types of Eastern meditation techniques, and you can see all sorts of effects. Primarily, you see effects on the brain as well as the effect on the on the immune system. But how these work, if you do something every day for 2 hours, you do a day in, day out, for weeks, for months, for years, it is going to change your brain. There's no question about it, no matter what it is. How these things work is, at this point, we have very little idea.
Well, I just think always of Oliver Sacks and his work. You have people who seem to have brains that don't function, and then suddenly music will have an effect on them that in no way could have been predicted. I mean, there was, in fact, a movie made out of this about a guy who was completely non-communicative and couldn't really use his brain much. And then when he heard music, he suddenly went back to the period when he had an accident and was able to talk freely. I mean, these areas are very mysterious and enigmatic to us still.
Yes, that's correct. But we're beginning to sort of shed light on them, using these various techniques. And this is the only way how we're going to understand. It is by far the most complex system in the known universe.
Yeah, it's like a universe unto itself, actually. Let me bring another caller
in here. It is your only universe. It's the way you experience the world is given by your brain. It is your very, this is what you experience. That's what your brain does.
Here's Toby. Toby, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Well, the comment from one of the doctors earlier about MRIs, and I worked for 10 years in neurosurgery at UCSF and in the 80s, and working with so many brain tumor patients, working 12-hour shifts, often 6 days a week, I used to think everybody should get an MRI when they graduate high school, so then they know whether they have a brain tumor or not and can live their life in a different way. So that's what prompted me to call. I want to ask a question I teach nursing now, and I utilize TED Talks a lot with my students. I wanted to know if the doctors have taken their research and condensed it to a TEDx or a TED Talk so I could share their work with my students.
Yeah, I think Carl Zimmer is a journalist. Christoph Koch, I think, is a PhD and a scientist. So we're speaking about one doctor here, I believe. But Christoph Koch, want to talk about that in terms of as you see it?
Yeah, so we do have so I've given TED Talks, and we've done a number of TED Talks. Now, regarding the MRI scan, like any medical diagnostic, there's also, you know, as you well know, false positives. So if you get routinely everybody in the population a scan, you're going to discover lots of things that are different in somebody's brain, and then they become highly anxious, and you know, they want surgery. While in most of the time, if you do what's called so-called incidental discovery, it really doesn't matter unless you have any symptoms. So in general, it's not a good idea to scan sort of everybody, just because you're going to discover things that people will get very nervous about, but they don't, as long as they're inert and they don't do anything, why get them operated? Any operation has a certain amount of risk associated with it. So in general, you should only get a brain scan if you have some symptoms, you know, if you have strong headaches that don't go away, or you had a trauma or a particular accident.
Again, Carl Koch is a neuroscientist and chief scientific officer with the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. And Mary writes, let me go to some of your emails. So please thank Mr. Zimmer for the wonderful articles he has written for the New York Times and the Yale Environmental 360 about issues in ecology, such as the rapid evolution of animals in the parks of New York, or his interview with Dove Sachs about the ecological benefits of non-native species, or the way weeds can rapidly evade the pesticides we are pouring on them. He is making important contributions to the debate about the hypotheses of invasion biology. Nice to get those props, Carl Zimmer, but maybe I can just ask you at this point, what makes you want to write about the brain?
Oh, it's just endlessly surprising. If you go to the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience, it is almost terrifying how much is going on. There are 30,000-40,000 people there, many of them presenting new research, and so there's just no end of stuff to discover, and you know, and every aspect of our psychological life is being picked apart there. Now, it's not as if, you know, neuroscientists can, you know, explain everything about what it means to be alive, to be a human being, but they have an awful lot to say. And so, yeah, I mean, there's no end of stuff to write about. I mean, it was painful trying to write this article for National Geographic. It's a nice big cover story, so I got plenty of room, but I was actually hacking things out because there just wasn't enough room to write about all the stuff that was so interesting to discuss.
Before I go to more of your calls, let me go to some emails here. Paul asks, one of your guests talked of the theory of the brain. I wonder if either of them has any comment on the recent insights from serious scientists related to the possibility of quantum vibrations as an underpinning of consciousness.
Yeah, so many people have over the last 30 years. In fact, it goes way back all the way to the origin of quantum mechanics in 1920 by John von Neumann, have postulated that sort of consciousness is required for what's called the collapse of the wave function. But the evidence we have right now is sort of that the large-scale quantum mechanical phenomena operating in the brain is very, very scant. It is true the brain, like any other object in the universe, is subject to the laws of quantum mechanics. But people sort of now believe that they are sort of a quantum computer. They talk about these quantum oscillations, etc. But again, the evidence for all of that is very, very minimal right now. So it's not a sort of a favored hypothesis by the vast number of by the vast fraction of neuroscientists.
Here's another listener, John, who writes on our webpage, and you can, by the way, put your comments on our webpage, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. This is another question from him. He says, can either guest address oxytocin's relation to the brain and give a basic overview of what happiness is or how to cultivate these good molecules in the brain, maintain a healthy brain?
Carl?
Well, oxytocin is an important chemical in the brain. It tends to turn up in interesting situations. So, for example, when mothers are with their babies, they're producing oxytocin. It appears to be important in situations where there's social bonding going on. And it's not just for humans, but for other mammals. So this is a this is a chemical that has been around for a long time, playing some really important roles in our social lives. Now, unfortunately, a lot of subtle, complex research in this area is getting kind of squished down into kind of a simplistic thinking that oxytocin is, you know, the love molecule or the happiness molecule, and that's just not true. I mean, oxytocin can turn up in some kind of ugly social situations like aggression. And so a fellow science writer named Ed Yong, Y-O-N-G, wrote about this, I believe, last year in Slate, on the website Slate. So if you just look for that, he really wrote sort of the definitive takedown of this sort of simplistic view of oxytocin. So do not go, you know, looking online to buy oxytocin to make yourself happy or to, you know, make sure that your date tonight goes really well by sort of spritzing the air. That's not how it works.
Isn't ecstasy related to oxytocin, the use of ecstasy?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly ecstasy creates that feeling of kind of well-being. I'm sorry, Christoph, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Bring on another caller. Lauren, thank you for waiting. Join us. Hi, good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. I have a question for both your guests regarding research around any sort of brain transplantation, and this may be entirely in the realm of science fiction, but are they aware of any research going on about transplanting either organic or synthetic material to help with traumatic brain injury?
Well, in the 80s, there were experiments where they did where they transplanted fetus cells into the brain of Parkinson patients, both in Mexico and in Sweden. There was a great deal of hope around there that maybe you could help these Parkinson patients by injecting new cells that were functioning and that they would build themselves and add themselves to the brain of these sick patients, but those never turned out. Then there are stem cell therapies right now that people, which are very much at the experimental stage, where we're taking stem cells, cells that are capable of being any type of cells, including nerve cells, into the brain of some people with injuries. So in an attempt for those cells to replace the defective cells, that looks very promising, but it's still very much experimental work.
And once again, Christoph Koch is a neuroscientist. He's chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. And here's a question for you, Dr. Koch. David says, the brain of a teacup poodle is much smaller than the brain of a standard poodle. To the human observer, either sized dog seems to be completely and equally capable. Makes one wonder, when you speak of mouse versus human, how much size matters. How do the numbers of neurons compare between the large and small poodles?
That's a very good question. I'm very interested in that because, you know, I love dogs. It's not really known. People have not done, if you look at all the different, you know, if you go between a Chihuahua and a, you know, a Great Dane or something, or, you know, a Saint Bernard, the brain differs, the body differs by factor 10 or more. The brain differs somewhat less, and there's believed to be a scaling relationship in general. If you go across species, from mouse to humans to apes to elephants, in general, the bigger the animal, the bigger the species, the more body mass, the larger the brain. But I agree, it's very puzzling right now how a Chihuahua and, you know, a Saint Bernard, they seem to have the same level of intelligence. And it does indeed put a question at what is the relationship between the size of the brain and the intelligence of that species. If you look at a great whale or you look at an elephant, their brains are 3 to 4 times bigger than our brains. Now, we think, of course, we like to think we are the top of the chain, we're the best, we're the smartest. So there is a paradox there. If we are really the smartest, how come they have bigger brains? Is it also true that the nerve cells are bigger and maybe they have smaller number of cells, but they're actually bigger than ours?
Yeah, but like I said earlier, men have bigger brains than women. I mean, and women can be a lot smarter than men.
Yeah, so those are all good questions to which we don't have final answers at this point. Very good question.
Yeah, let me bring another caller in here, and that's you, Paul. Hi.
Hi. Alzheimer's disease, I'm a naturopathic doctor, and Alzheimer's disease, we believe, is caused by an excess of certain vegetable oils and a shortage of selenium. So from that, most naturopathic doctors recommend minerals into the diet in order to improve the brains of people, and selenium is also thought to discourage cancer, prevent the brain from rusting and developing brain cancer if you have a high enough level of selenium. So, I mean, basically, if you talk to my patients this way and that way, encourage them to help their brain chemistry by maintaining high enough levels of selenium that they prevent problems and that way keep their brain healthy, because basically the brain is minerals and proteins, so on a simple basis.
Well, comment from either Christoph Koch or Carl Zimmer?
Well, I mean, I would need to see a clinical trial that actually showed that selenium supplements actually cured Alzheimer's. I mean, if you don't have that sort of evidence, then we really shouldn't take that seriously. You can't sort of draw dots between little bits of data and come up with a really broad claim about something as serious as Alzheimer's.
Now, what about these broad claims about cell phones in the brain? Do we know much that we can at least rely on in that context, Carl Zimmer?
I haven't seen anything that really, offers a really clear link between cell phones and brain cancer. These sorts of associations are difficult to work on, because you have to find a lot of people, you have to randomize your trial, you have to make sure that you're not dealing with clusters that just happen just out of randomness. This is not easy stuff to do, but that doesn't mean that we can therefore just jump to easy conclusions in the absence of that kind of rigorous research.
And we bring
one thing we can see for certain, that if you use your cell phone when you're driving, that's really bad.
Yes, thank you for that. Stephen, it doesn't show much brain, actually. Stephen, go ahead. You're on the air.
The question I have is, when are we going to develop neurolinguistics? We seem to be very far from the stage where we can understand what a thought is, a communication within the brain. It appears that right now we are just looking down on a computer as if we've opened up an iPhone and looked at a chip and just see which is active and inactive and trying to discern what the language of the computer is, what the BIOS is. I don't think we have the tools yet, and I hope we'll see them develop sometime soon, that we can actually discern what a thought is and what a communication is within the brain. Everything else seems to be incredibly top-level and superficial at this point.
Yeah, Christoph Koch?
Well, I mean, yes, you're right. We have lots of theories. We have certain mathematical tools. We don't have a final theory yet, as Carl mentioned. We can read out certain types of thoughts, so you can now actually get people inside scanners and you can get them to think simple things, or you can get them to watch movies, and you can actually infer from the outside using brain imaging what they're thinking of in very simple scenarios where they're thinking one of two things. But in general, we don't know right now what the exact correlates of thoughts are. Our science is relatively young. It's 100 or 150 years old compared to physics, which is 300 years old, and physics, of course, deals with simpler systems than biology. So give us some more time.
Well, speaking about things we don't know, I've got a listener who emails this question, a listener named Tadashi, says, the need for sleep seems to be universal among brains. What is the latest thinking regarding the mechanism of this mystery?
The latest thought is that the so-called shy hypothesis, synaptic homeostasis hypothesis, that you need sleep, particularly non-REM sleep now, to rejuvenate sort of your synapses, that your synapses during the day you learn, you constantly experience new things. Some of them stick in your memory and remain there. But so during the night, you have to recalibrate and reset your synapses. There's quite a bit of molecular and systems level evidence for that. So that would explain why you would have a non-REM sleep, the one where you don't tend to dream.
We'll bring another caller on. And Ricardo, that's you. Good morning.
Hello, Michael. Good morning to you, and happy Martin Luther King Day to everyone, and your guest also. Fascinating program. I'm bringing up the issue of cell phones and electromagnetic field radiation on brains as to cell phones. There was a case that finished itself off about 2 years ago now in Italy of a man who sued Nokia and other cell phone companies in Italy and won several million dollars for developing tumors over either ear, the inner ear, back of the ear, related to using cell phones over 8 hours a day because of the obligation of work duties. So he was using a cell phone, and the electromagnetic field actually just infuse the specific neural pathways, neurons, what have you, within the brain areas around the ear to actually go to tumor levels.
Ricardo, before we get a response to that from our guests, and I know they'll want to weigh in here. I knew when I brought up cell phones that we get a lot of calls. I just want to bring in another caller who wants to address the same issue. Stan, that's you. Go ahead.
Yes. When we switched to smartphone technology, we switched to microwave technology. And this brain imaging stuff you're talking about, not only has it repeatedly shown, it's very clear. You put a cell phone up to your ear, and you get microwaved into the brain, and the brain reacts to it. It's not a question, guys. Please stop presenting bad science when there's plenty of proof. Go to LifeWave.com or any of these other places that make shields for phones, and they will show you all of the studies on this stuff. Come on, guys. Stop saying that this is not hurting humans, because it's not only hurting humans, it's especially bad for children.
I don't know if anybody said it's hurting. I think, Carl Zimmer, you were saying we don't have incontrovertible proof at this stage or empirical proof that can say without question.
Telling me that, you know, one person won a court case about this is not the same as a large-scale study. You know, it's not epidemiology. We have to have these kind of large-scale studies to really see if there's an effect, and if there is an effect, what the dose is, and so on. And, you know, if you look at that literature, it's not this some sort of, you know, overwhelming plague that we're being told it is here. That's just how science works. And if people don't like it, I can't change that.
Well, we'll end on that note because we've come to the end of the program here. It's been a fascinating hour. I want to thank both of you. In fact, I want to recommend Carl Zimmer's excellent article, A Voyage into the Brain. It's a cover story of the latest National Geographic magazine, the February 2014 issue of National Geographic. Carl Zimmer, thank you for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you.
And also want to thank Christoph Koch, who joined us on the program as well, neuroscientist, chief scientific officer with the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. Good luck in the Super Bowl with the Seahawks, even though we're tasting the bitterness still here in San Francisco.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Good to have had you with us, and good to have had you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to appropriate on this Martin Luther King Day, meet Glenda Hope, who has done work with poor and homeless, extraordinary work for many, many years now. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi today. Christina Russo and Tina Larberg are our producers. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.